Can a survey change the future? Maybe this one can. Cannabis education is inconsistent at best and missing or misleading at worst. How can we make cannabis education better? What if we ask people who use or are thinking about using cannabis a bunch of questions? What if we ask pharmacists who could be teaching people about cannabis a bunch of questions? And then, what if the answers from those questions were used to help pharmacists teach people about cannabis better? Well, this is exactly what pharmacists as cannabis educators, or PACE, are doing. And PACE needs you to fill out a survey. PACE needs as many people as possible to fill out a survey. PACE needs you to fill out a survey on or before May 12th. This is a limited time offer for you to help change the future of cannabis education. To participate, go to promo.reefermed.ca. That's promo, P-R-O-M-O.reefermed.ca.
Reefer Madness, the podcast, would like to acknowledge that we produce our shows on Treaty 2 territory and homeland of the Métis. We pay our respects to the First Nations and Métis ancestors of this land, and we reaffirm our relationships.
It's Reefer Madness, the podcast, with Trevor and Kirk.
Kirk, we're back.
Hey, Trevor, how are you?
I am well. It looks like you're in your basement.
I am. I'm setting up my basement as my new office space. Yeah.
Very nice. So, I talked to Dr. Jennifer Anderson.
You did. I found it a fascinating story. I was out cutting my grass, and I was listening to the interview, and I kept saying to myself, this is really another My Cannabis story.
It kind of is, and, you know, also one of those interesting how cannabis affected my life, but the person whose life was affected was a physician, so you can then ask her a whole bunch of other questions.
Yeah, it's I kept listening to, you know, it's funny thing about pharmacists and nurses, our brain looks at things differently, right? I kept looking for this to be a clinical question. When are you going to get into the clinical questions? Because right now you're exploring her experiences becoming a cannabis doctor. And that's what I found this to be. That this is a My Cannabis story of a doctor who learned to use cannabis because of one of her children, and in the journey has become the person she was looking for at the beginning of her journey.
Yeah, and we'll get to more of that later, but yeah, listeners, listen for now. Remember, this did start a little bit before recreational legalization, but honestly, I don't think it's too much different today. If you are trying to find a cannabis doctor, it's not always easy. So just, you know, listen to all the struggles she went through, you know, even after she'd realized cannabis is good for her, good for her child, good for the situation, how many hoops she had to go through to get a physician to agree to help her with this. And she's a doctor. Who knows other doctors? It was not easy.
You know, it was interesting. She's talking to you and you ask her the question and you say, oh, the specialist, the pediatric specialist, seizure specialist is going to report you to the college. And my brain was going, no, Trevor, not the college. They're talking about social services.
Yeah, so that's exactly what she said.
Yeah. And I'm thinking to myself, because I'm thinking as a nurse, I'm thinking, no, man, they're going to report her to social services because she's giving her own child cannabis without a prescription. She's in big trouble. This is what I'm thinking. So yeah, again, not giving anything away. There's a little bit of a cliffhanger, and I was thinking, no, Trevor, it's the wrong question. She's going to be a report, and sure enough, no, it's social services. Yeah. So can you imagine, Trevor, this is a family physician, and the role of a family physician in today's medicine, when I first started nursing 40 years ago, the family physician that I was working with started in the 30s, and he was all-encompassing, all-knowledgeable, and everything he said was right. Today's family physicians are a little different. Their job is to sort of be the gatekeeper and help their patients, the seasoned specialists. The information comes back, and then they're supposed to manage the care.
Yeah, so, I've heard it described as kind of like the quarterback of team health.
Yeah, well, in my practice, when I was practicing up north, that's what the nursing stations did. It was part of our responsibility as nurses in primary care to sort of coordinate all that. But so in today's busy society, busy practices, doctors don't always get a chance to do this, and I think they lose track. So here is a physician trying to maneuver through the system as a customer. And I say customer because I keep forgetting, I think healthcare providers keep forgetting that we provide a service. So therefore, yes, we have patients, yes, we have clients, but ultimately they are our customers. They are here to get a service from us. So here is a family physician not getting any service, but yet she knows how to manipulate the system and she keeps going into blind alleys. It's fascinating, fascinating story.
And you know what? Let's just let Dr. Anderson talk and we'll have a couple more comments at the end.
Dr. Anderson, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
The first time, well, probably not the first time I heard about you. We've talked to and about Dr. Shelley Turner for quite a while. So we'd sort of heard about you through her. But I think the first time I heard you talk was I was at a cannabis talk by Spectrum Therapeutics. They put on a nice series of talks. And I heard about your sort of story about how you went from a skeptical family physician about cannabis to one who is quite pro. Can you kind of lead our listeners through what happened?
Absolutely. Yes. I graduated in 2014 from family medicine. And at that time, medical cannabis was legal. It has been since 2000. But, you know, family docs were not giving a whole lot of training on it. And I was taking over a practice for another physician, and he had a few patients that were on cannabis. You know, and at that time, you know, coming out of residency, it wasn't something I really wanted to delve into. I did have a brother that did really well with cannabis for pain. So it wasn't like I didn't believe in it. It was just a matter of not something I felt the need to touch on at the time. So I didn't take a few patients at that time and ended up having some complaints about that. So it kind of went from this, you know, a doctor that wasn't really willing to go there. And then the year after that, a few years into my clinic, my son, who is a donor twin in a twin transfusion syndrome, and he has cerebral palsy, intractable epilepsy, over the previous years his seizures had just started to escalate. So in 2016, we spent most of the year in the hospital, and leading up to October of 2016, he was in the hospital all the time, in ICU, you know, and we would just kind of get home for a day or two and then be calling ambulances because of his seizures. So at that time, you know, I started to look into other options. We had a meeting with his neurologist and she basically asked me if I wanted him resuscitated. And I think at that point, I just, everything sort of hit me that, you know, I think you just keep going when you have a child that's in hospital and you're trying to work. But at that time, you know, I started to panic. I went and I quit my job because I just couldn't handle that. I couldn't even get to work at that time. So, you know, I went and I just started working emergency because I could literally go from the children's hospital in the morning, go to work and come back. They were 8-hour shifts. I could move them around. When I was done work, I didn't have anything else I had to do. So
You're living at the hospital.
Pretty much. Yeah. Oh yeah. Wow. Because I was going from one to the other. I would literally tell the nurses, I'll be right back as soon as I'm done my shift, you know, and then I had a respite person that was helping me with the other twin who they were like 3 years old at the time. So, and then my daughter who was a few years older. So, you know, I just basically was living on nothing. And so, you know, I went online, I found the, news report by Sanjay Gupta, the CNN report on Charlotte Figge. You know, I started to look into that. I went to my neurologist and I said, what do you think about cannabis? You know, like there's really no other options. We had to take him off of valproic acid because of his bone marrow suppression. And you know, he was seizing multiple times an hour. A lot of times we couldn't even tell if he was in a seizure or out of a seizure. You know, we're just kind of guessing how many he was having each hour. And at night he was up all the time seizing. So I would be up most of the night as well watching him. So anyways, I went to his neurologist and I asked about it. She had actually trained, I think, in some of the centers in the States that were doing the Epidiolex trials. And so she basically said to me, it could work, but I can't help you with it. And I said, okay, so what do I do? She said, you have to find a family doctor who's an expert in cannabis as well as epilepsy, and they can hopefully help you. And I said, well, how do I do that? Do you know any? She goes, I can't help you with that.
I'm just going to say that's not even common now, but a few years ago, that would have been really hard to find.
Yes, this is 2016. So this is before recreational legalization as well. So, you know, I had a blog on my Facebook just talking about our challenges with the twins in general since they were born. And I started just talking on there about how I wanted to try cannabis. And one of my friends who I'd grown up with actually had been trying Charlotte's Web with her son, who was autistic at the time. Still autistic. But she didn't find that it was helping. And she messaged me and she said, you know, Jen, I have this extra Charlotte's Web. Do you want to give it a try? And I was desperate. It was a Friday night. I remember I was exhausted. I went and I it was like $200 for this bottle. But I mean, I didn't feel like I had any other options. So I brought it home. I gave him one drop and I put him to bed. I didn't know how much to give him. So anyways, and he slept the whole night, and he hadn't slept the whole night forever. I was up all night watching him. And in the morning I gave him another drop and he had seizures through the day, no real change. And I didn't really think anything of the first night. And then the second night I gave him another drop and he slept the whole night. And that continued. And on the Monday, the daycare basically said, like, he's a different kid. All of a sudden he was awake. It was like he woke up. He just had a different look. He was alert. He was paying attention to things around him. He was, you know, playing with kids. You know, he was just alert and came alive. So, you know, things just gradually improved. My respite person at the time, she said, you know, Nicholas is walking fine again, because he had regressed and he was starting to crawl again. Now he was walking, you know, he was starting to do the things that he could do before. And he just sort of regressed throughout that summer. So people around us started noticing. I had told my neurologist that, well, she had asked if I would tell her if we were going to start any type of cannabis, because he was on clobazam and we need to pay attention to that. And so I told her, and the response was, who is helping you with that in terms of physician? And I said, well, no, nobody, it's hemp. She's like, no, you still need somebody, you know, and through talking to a few of the neurologists and that, you know, the answer was, you need to go find someone within the next day or two, or we're going to have to report that you're using, that you're giving your child cannabis.
Before you get to that, just because, this is a fascinating bit, but just because you're not just a regular mom, you're a physician mom, any chance, and I'm sure you mulled this all over your head, any chance that the condition you're son had could just sort of spontaneously go away, you know, that this was just a coincidence, a placebo thing? Did you think, was that ever a possibility that this was just getting better on its own?
No. So my son's brain developed completely abnormally due to the twin transfusion syndrome. So that's the source of his seizures. And we were basically just told, even when he was a baby, that he might not have anything but reflexes. I pushed him and we got him all of the help we could. And he's, you know, he's just behind his brother in terms of walking and, and that he's, but, you know, the seizures we were told were going to escalate. And once you start having seizures, you have more seizures, you create these circuits in the brain. And so, you know, our conversations with neurology were basically at the point of asking if we wanted him resuscitated, because there was nothing else other than adding more medications. And as I learned more about seizures, you know, I learned that after two medications, you know, your chance of controlling seizures after two medications is really low. So it doesn't really, you can just keep adding medications, but you're really adding side effects.
Nope. Fair enough. And I'm sorry. So your neurologist was threatening to call the college on you and...
Yeah, well, I think it was more, you know, child and family services, okay. You know, for but obviously my license would have been on the line as well. And I think that shocked me because here I had a child who was completely different after a week. And I was being told to stop the cannabis until I found someone that would help me with it. And I said, well, he could die because kids that have seizures have always a risk of sudden unexpected death and epilepsy. That's called SUDEPS. And so if you're seizing multiple times an hour, like your chance of dying is huge. And so I said, you know, he could die. And the response I got was, yeah, he might. But I felt, you know, I felt
it's a terrible thing to hear as a parent.
Yeah, I mean, I can still hear it in my head. And it wasn't actually my neurologist. I'll make that clear because I really like our neurologist. And I think she's done everything that she could do, having her hands tied by the department. But it was one of the other neurologists that was on call. And I remember that conversation and thinking, what is wrong with our system? This is crazy. You know, and here I am a mom, but also a physician thinking, how many other kids are out here like this? Right. I mean, what happens when you don't have any options? Like, at what point does someone say that's wrong to try? I mean, obviously, you're not going to give yourself something, your kids something that's, you know, is going to hurt them. But, you know, I think that whole experience in my life has really helped me to understand other families. Like, if I'm just jumping ahead a little bit, like, you know, I look at kids differently. I look at families differently. And I've, you know, it's just, it's helped put things in perspective. But yeah, so at that time I was told to stop it. Of course I didn't. And I went to the head of PEDS oncology, the head of PEDS palliative. I thought if anyone's going to help me, it'll be the doctors that are in charge of all these kids with these horrible issues. Right. But nope, they're, one of them was, you know, I knew pretty closely and I said, he just said, Jen, I can't help you. Not at this time anyways. And I mean, it's a hard ask. So I totally respect that decision, but it was so frustrating that there was nobody. And I was basically supposed to go find a family doctor, like not even a specialist, a family doctor. And at that time, lots of them were operating on the corner and things like that. Right. And they basically give you your authorization and no instruction. So I just, it was so bizarre. So anyways, long story short, after being completely desperate, one of my family doc friends that worked Emerge with me, she said, Jen, I'll help you. And we sat down together. She'd never done it before. We wrote what we thought was an authorization and I called the neurologist. Neurologist is like, hey, great. At least basically, at least I can write down that you're getting it legally. So,
okay.
And yeah. So that's how we started. And then from there, it just got better and better. And, you know, we drastically reduced our hospital stays the first year, I would say 50% each year until now we have not been in hospital for seizures since, for 4 years.
For 4 years. Wow. Yeah. That was going to be my next question is how's he doing now? And seizure free for 4 years is amazing.
So he's not seizure free.
Okay. Hospital free.
Hospital free. Yes. Okay. So we do have ups and downs. He will have sometimes he has episodes too that we're not sure if they're seizures. We had some ups and downs this year. We had a planned hospital stay to sort of watch him on a video EEG. So that was the only sort of hospitalization we've had. But you know, some of his seizures are so far in the brain that they don't actually show on an EEG. And what I've learned is actually the EEG only picks up seizures that are in the cortex.
Really?
If any deep brain seizures won't show, to my or to what I understand, you know, they're hard to detect on an EEG. So just because a child is not showing a seizure on an EEG doesn't mean they're not having one. So you know, that was really interesting because Nicholas doesn't have the generalized tonic-clonic seizures. He has vomiting seizures. He has lots of other seizures that were hard to recognize. He started off with having electrical status epilepsy in sleep. So basically every time he went to sleep, he was in status. That took forever to diagnose. He was up at like 10 p.m., 3 a.m. With these like shaking, vomiting episodes. And I'd be going to the neurologist and saying, I think these are seizures. And then I was in the ER, just working and I'd be like researching on medical sites, you know, what are these nighttime seizures? And I came back and I'm like, I think he's got like ESES, electrical status epilepsy and sleep. Like, no, he's never been diagnosed. The EEGs are fine. Cause we were actually going to Florida. This is when he was like two. Mm-hmm. And, I said, can I please have some lorazepam? I don't want to end up in the hospital. You know, I'm pretty sure these are seizures. And the neurologist at that time, now retired. But she said, you know, Jen, I've never diagnosed him with epilepsy. You know, it's absolutely, I'm not going to give you lorazepam. I'm like, okay, fine. Like, what do I know? I'm just like a family doctor. So anyways, we went to Florida. He had episodes like crazy. I came back and I went to the neurologist. I'm like, this is not right. Anyway, so then they did a 5-day home EEG and they called us back and said, oh, by the way, he's seizing all night. So anyway, it's been a real journey learning about seizures. And that's my point. Even yeah. Neurologists sometimes do not pick up seizures. So
no, and it sounds like you've become sort of a, what I don't want to call it, an amateur neurologist along the way.
Not anywhere close, but I do understand, you know, the struggles that my parents go through. So, yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about what you're doing in your practice now. So a lot of your practice revolves around cannabis now, right?
It does. I still do work emergency, but on the side. So in 2017, I was actually working in Emerge and one of the someone from one of the cannabis clinics in the city came out to the ER to talk to me because they said, you know, we have all these families coming with these kids with epilepsy wanting cannabis, but not even the cannabis doctors will touch them. And so I said, you know what? Absolutely not. I'm not going to be the pot doc for kids. I said, okay. Because I was still traumatized by my own experience. You know, but after a few months, and actually learning a lot more about cannabis, I made some colleagues in the field, that really explained things. I thought, no, there's actually a method to this. And I started pulling the papers from Israel and looking at the studies and trying to figure out the dosing. And so I started seeing kids in the early 2017, just kind of quietly. And I would actually write a letter back to their neurologist saying your patient, came to me wanting, to see about cannabis because they've failed this, and this. I've agreed to see them. I'm just giving you a courtesy letter to let you know because there are some drug interactions and things like that. So that's kind of how it started. But after doing that for a while, I started actually getting consults. So, you know, it started with, you know, some family doctors, then like some pediatricians, then it and different random specialists, rheumatologists, and, you know, various specialists. But then also then in the last year or two, neurology has started to send their kids. So it's just exploded into a consult-based practice over since 2017. And we've just moved into a new space that's a medical clinic. Okay. And, you know, we're also doing a research center that we're just sort of doing ethics proposals and stuff for. So in the next 6 months, we should have all that up and running. And that will be based out of the Children's Research Center in Manitoba.
Cool.
And so, yeah, it's a lot of things on the go right now, but it's been amazing to work with other physicians now and everybody as a team with these kids.
And I don't want to run out of time, but I want to take a little bit of a left turn. There is a documentary out now. I believe it's most about like you and your son and your journey. Do I have that right?
Yeah. So the documentary is not quite out yet. We're still trying. We're figuring out where it's going to be showing. It's called Anything Can Happen, and it basically talks about my story as a physician and as a mom. And then it goes through three of my patients that I agreed to be on the documentary, two with autism and one with epilepsy, and just what cannabis meant to them and how they see it working with their child. It's a really non-biased film. It's about 42 minutes and it really just gets people thinking. It's a platform for discussion.
Fantastic. Now, we had a little bit of time trouble, well, because I send weird emails too, but we had a little bit of trouble scheduling you for this because you've been all over North America lately talking at various conferences. Where have you been lately and what are people asking you to talk about?
So I did go to two conferences in May that made the month a little bit crazy. I went to Lyft & Co. in Toronto, and there I was on a panel talking about models of care for cannabis and like clinic models. And so there was a few of us on there just talking about what patients need, what we felt was important for patients in terms of their continuity of care. I had the opportunity just to talk about what we've done in Manitoba with kids. We're the only province really that has a consult-based center for these kids. There are some of my colleagues in other provinces, but there's the structure of their practice is a little bit different. So,
and maybe I should jump in because not everyone's going to know what that means. What does a consult-based center mean?
So basically for any other specialty, a family doctor, for example, if you needed something cardiac or heart-wise, your doctor would consult cardiology about it, and you would go see the cardiologist, and then you would come back to your family doctor. And your family doctor generally is the one that ties everything together in terms of the patient's care. At least that's the way it's supposed to work. So with a consult-based practice like this, I'm basically operating as a family doc that has a special interest in cannabis. I can get, other doctors sending their patients to me, then I sort of help them with that patient. So it's a really collaborative care approach.
Okay. So Lyft & Co. sort of talking about we'll call it how to set up patient care and how the care is differing across the country. Where else were you in May?
Then I went to the Cannabis Science Conference. I was asked to be part of a panel there as well with Bonnie Goldstein and Tracy Ryan and a few others talking about both physician and patient experiences with cannabis and kids. So I got to talk a little bit about my journey as a mom. But also my journey from going from a mom to a physician who looks after all these kids, and just a little bit of the advocacy that we've done to try to change policy, education, and various things as we go along.
Very cool. So let's swing back to your practice now. Are most of the people you're seeing now kids and kids with epilepsy, or is it kind of all over the map?
So I do see some adults, but it is getting to be more and more kids. I would say that the majority of the kids I see have epilepsy. I do have kids that have autism, and we try to see whether we can find a form of CBD that will be effective for different challenges. I do get a lot of kids from oncology now. With various types of cancers, especially the palliative ones. So I liaise with the palliative team and the oncology team. And we're always in really close communication, which is great. There's interactions with different drugs that they're on. So we need to all be very close with these kids.
No, good. And obviously, we'll start with the caveat. Don't do this at home. Don't do this without talking to your physician. But so when you were giving cannabis to kids, I'm assuming this is all oral oils, or am I wrong? How do you get it into the shoulder?
Actually, that's a common question. I do still get asked if the kids smoke.
Okay.
So I'm like, no, they don't. Yes, we do use oils. Usually they're easier to dose. And we have to use products from Health Canada licensed producers legally. So we use oils. They go through a G-tube generally, or they are taken orally. The kids I work with have various ways that they eat. So,
okay. And because I hear this complaint from adults, people don't generally like the taste of the cannabis oils. How are you, and taste is a big deal for some kids anyway, how are you, the kids who are not going through a tube, who have to taste it on the way down, have you found any tips and tricks for getting it into them?
Absolutely. We have done lots of problem solving. So generally, we start with putting it in something fatty. We do know that the oils get absorbed the best with something fatty. So peanut butter, yogurt, things like that. We also have gotten local pharmacies to compound it and add flavorings and try to change the taste, which is great. So those two things, you know, I am looking forward to when we have a few different options for products. Unfortunately, some of the other products like the dissolvable strips and things like that, they are just way too expensive for these kids. You know, with the dosing of CBD, according to the studies, you know, some of these kids are on, you know, 100 to 300 milligrams of CBD. So it's just, they can't afford all the fancy stuff.
Okay. And I don't tell me who they are, so I don't want to get my pharmacy colleagues in trouble. But when we asked about things like compounding it, we were told by our college that, you know, as a pharmacist in Manitoba, thou shall not have any cannabis products in your pharmacy at all, you know, not even compounding with it. Any idea how they're getting around that? Just, you know, as a professional
curiosity? You know what? I'm not a pharmacist. Okay. I'm not a pharmacist. And, you know, I think that the patient brings the oil and then they do something. I don't know exactly what they're doing. I just know that the families are reporting that the pharmacy is helping them.
So you've mentioned CBD a lot. Is that predominantly what you're using with your kids, or are you using any THC or any other cannabinoids, or, hey, this terpene works well in autism, or anything along those lines?
Unfortunately, in Canada, we are really tied with kids right now. There are no Health Canada licensed producers that are producing the minor cannabinoids, which is what we want. So we are using this high CBD products. I have my favorite to go to, just that I know that have worked, and it is because of the terpenes that I think there's a difference. I am looking forward to the day when we have more full spectrum products and minor cannabinoids that we can add to preparations in the Health Canada licensed producer side, because that's what we have to have with kids.
Oh, cool. What in your research, what do you think, which minor cannabinoids do you think might be helpful for what?
Oh, that's a good, I mean,
I know a whole other different top, but just,
yeah,
just
a that's couple, a whole different a topic. I would just say, I wish I could have CBDA and THCA, as well as maybe some CBG, CBN, and I work with a lot of different ages, including adults. So those would be the ones on my list.
Okay, that's been really great, and you've been very generous with your time. And like we ask everybody, is there anything you wished I'd asked, or any other sort of rabbit holes you wished we'd gone down before we let you go?
No, I think we covered quite a lot. You know, I'm just really finding that I'm focusing more on educating other physicians and trying to educate just anyone, because I find once people understand more about cannabis and how it can be used and that there's actual research, people start to listen. And it doesn't matter if they're in the healthcare community or in politics or education, everyone has an interest, and you kind of need everybody to change policy.
Okay, Kirk, again, I love that talk. I'm so excited that Dr. Anderson gave us a little bit of her time. She is a busy woman. And just a quick aside, I swear after 2 years of this Zoom stuff, I should be getting better at this. But in addition, she was at all these conferences. It was hard to find a date, yada, yada. But apparently, in addition to everything else, I invited her to a Paxlovid talk, which Paxlovid, for those of you who don't know, is a drug to treat COVID-19. And I was going to a Paxlovid talk. So instead of sending her the Zoom invite to talk to me, I sent her the Zoom invite to a Paxlovid talk. And she answered back, "So you're doing a Paxlovid talk?" "No, no, no. I'm trying to learn about Paxlovid." So yeah. 2 years into this, apparently I still can't send out Zoom invites right. But back to the actual story. I wrote it down, a twin donor syndrome. So I read a little bit about it and something about sharing a placenta and some other stuff. So now we don't have... Can you tell them a little bit about what it is?
I had to do some research. So what a twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome, it has to do with it's a rare condition with twins or multiple twins. And it is, you're correct. It has to do with the twins sharing one placenta and a network of blood vessels and how that the blood is distributed between the two individuals, the twins. So sometimes what happens is the vessels that connect the placenta are not evenly dispensed throughout, so there's an imbalance. One twin becomes the donor twin, which means that twin is giving away more blood than it receives, and then one twin becomes the recipient twin, they receive too much blood. So it's an balance of blood, and because of that, morbidities and conditions can manifest from it. Without getting too deep in it, with her, of course, it became this cerebral palsy, and the...
She specifically said there were... The brain didn't develop properly. I think we can leave it at that.
Okay, sure. Yeah, so the brain doesn't mature appropriately, and therefore what happened is the child now is left with chronic seizure syndrome.
Yeah, to the point that it sounded like on at least one occasion, but one in particular, they asked if basically you wanted to put a do not resuscitate on your child,
which is
just... In case you missed the whole DNR thing, that's what we mean. Do not resuscitate. This is the, hey, if your kid goes into a really bad seizure and looks like they're going to die, do you want us to just let them die? Like, that's just a kick in the gut as a parent.
Yeah, no kidding, man. And to be a family physician, to go through this, astounding. I thought that was a really good My Cannabis story with a little bit of clinical work in it. I'd like to explore more the clinical side of children therapy using cannabis. And I think, did you have anything more you wanted to say about Jennifer, Dr. Anderson?
Because some things jump out at me. One of the seizure medication her child was on, valproic acid, I dispense it all the time. Just to be reminded, medications have side effects. I know, not as interesting to everybody else, but her kid was actually getting bone marrow suppression from it. And the other one that just sort of jumped out at me, because I have kids who are on multiple seizure medications, just the, if you're on two seizure medications, two or more, and it's not working, chances are another one's not going to work. Like, oh, that's just crappy. And we've heard from other people, other places about the good things cannabis, Epidiolex is CBD and trials in the States, but just sort of hits home that there's a whole bunch of seizure stuff that we might not be treating as well as we could be. And cannabis and CBD is obviously not the end all be all, but it seems terrible that we're not using it more, because there are certain patients that it seems to be doing wonders
for. And clinically, when we are dealing with valproic acid, I was involved with a few cases in the north, and we were drawing levels and it was determination to see if the child was getting the medicine, right? Because there was some issues about compliance. The child was still having seizure activity, and the nurses believe that there might have been a compliance issue with taking the meds, so we were drawing levels. And I understand, my practice is northern, so I think in acute care situations we do draw levels of medications when we're dealing with seizure activity. So my question was to you, and I sent the question to Dr. Anderson through LinkedIn about the therapeutic levels, biomarkers of cannabis when treating this, and her answer was let's see if I can read this. Thanks for your message. We currently don't track serum levels of cannabinoids. I'm not sure how helpful they would actually be. That is not a test that's available either. I'm not aware of any studies that show that levels of cannabinoids correlate with seizure frequencies. Most kids have different etiology of their seizures, which is probably why. So I fired it off to a couple other specialists. One name people might recognize, who I've been trying to get on our podcast forever, is Raphael Michalolim, and he is the Israeli scientist that discovered THC in cannabis, CBD, back in the 60s. And he turned me to Natalina Kojin, a colleague of his in Israel, and I've sent a message out to her asking about biomarkers and drawing cannabinoid levels. I've also sent an email to Catum Labs asking them about drawing cannabinoid levels, because I, again, thinking as a clinician, I'm wondering, somewhere someone must have been drawing levels, because I can't see why they would not be.
I don't know any more than you, but I'll throw on pharmacist hat and devil's advocate against the levels thing. So things like phenytoin, we draw levels because phenytoin, another seizure medication, because it has a narrow therapeutic index. If we give them too much, we're causing harm. And if we give them too little, we're not helping the seizure. So, you know, it's important to know where that phenytoin level is. I would argue with the CBD, because we don't have any, we have no idea. You know, let's say a test existed and we can find out what your CBD level was. We have no idea if, you know, a level of 5 in Kirk, if that's going to affect his seizures or not. And more importantly, even if a 5 consistently helps Kirk's seizures, 5 might not help Trevor's seizures at all. So I just don't think we have enough research out there to say this level helps seizures in this many people. And maybe just as importantly, again, I'm not as a promoting overdosing people, but because CBD is so safe, the chance of overdose is so low that I think it clinically it makes perfect sense to just treat to effect. You know, use the lowest dose possible to keep the seizures as least as possible, and that's fine. Now, it would be lovely over time if we can get some actual levels, but I think that's going to take a lot of years and a lot of research. But if somebody out there knows better than me, please let us know.
But there's the ultimate word that we keep coming in. There's not enough research to justify cannabis. It's all anecdotal. It's all observational. Well, okay, I agree. We are learning plant medicine. We observe our patient. We give them medications, and we observe. We individualize it. I get it. But there is research being done in autism for cannabinoid levels. And I did find a paper on that. And what they basically said, the conclusion of the paper was that the results of the cannabinoid responsive biomarker shift towards a therapeutic dose means after medical cannabis treatment and can potentially quantify benefits at the metabolic level. These changes appear to be similar to the trend described in behavior surveys. Larger trials need to be happening. So what they're basically saying is what they have done in small cohorts is that the observations that we're making, when they do check the levels and the observations measure, saying that at this level it works for this individual. So I guess if we're going to justify the use of cannabis, we need more studies.
Oh yeah.
So saying that we're not doing it because there's no studies is a cop-out of researchers, I guess. I'm calling them out. There's a lot of children who are being treated with cannabinoids for seizure activities. Not as many children being treated for other issues, but I mean, it's happening. So we should be measuring it. We should be coming up with those quantified numbers so that we can say with some sort of assurance that your child's best therapeutic dose of cannabis is this. You know, so
and that's all important, and I agree with all of that. But again, devil's advocate, and sorry, folks, if we're getting too much into the weeds. But if we go over to a different disease like COVID, you can measure COVID antibodies, and people go, "Oh, you've got COVID antibodies. You know, you're safe. You don't need this this Paxlovid. You don't need this monoclonal antibody because you've generated your own." The problem with that in COVID is, we have no idea how many COVID antibodies makes you protected. So just because we can measure something doesn't make it useful.
Yeah, no,
I would love the researchers to tell me, you know, this level in this type of seizure gives you protection. But even when that test becomes available, we just have to be careful about using it properly.
Yeah, I guess that's apple and oranges, in the sense that I understand immunizations because, I mean, I was immunized for typhoid fever. Back in 1984, I got all my immunizations. I traveled the world. I went to Asia, and I got myself into a bad situation, and I caught typhoid. I caught typhoid in India, and I spent a week in an Italian hospital in 1985 with typhoid. And I was properly immunized, and I had antibodies. But I was tired. I may have eaten a salad that may have been rinsed in water that had fecal matter in it, which is probably how it happened. I drank some milk, which I shouldn't have done. I made some mistakes traveling the way I was. I got typhoid with immunization. I think the question I'm asking is a little different because I'm asking about blood levels of a medication being used for a specific problem. So I'm, like I said, I'm hoping that I can talk to Catam Labs, talk to a lab expert. I don't even know if the province of Manitoba offers the service, but I think they do. Imagine in ERs, they're drawing drug profiles in the ER, and cannabinoids are one of them. You know,
I would almost guarantee they have a THC level because I guarantee somebody somewhere has been checked to see
I've done it.
Yeah, whether or not they're using cannabis.
Yeah, well, I've done it. I mean, in the north, part of our opiate, part of the opiate therapies is doctors request drug profiles from the patients so we know what. We know what they're doing, again, therapeutic levels of what we're given. So again, I'm looking at this purely as a clinician. I think that research needs to be happening, right? So I guess if Dr. Anderson's listening to me, I guess the question I'm having is, why not? And why can't we start it? So that we can basically say that, yes, it's individualized and we've got the paper, right? So anyways.
Yeah, we're way, way, way into the weeds. So anything else you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, I got lots of stuff I'm doing. Gee whiz. Upcoming stories. Canada's southern rock band, Wrecking So. They have played in Dauphin in the past. Are fans of ours. And I have a interview happening, I think, next Tuesday on this. And this has to do with Lyme disease.
Cool.
This is a gentleman that caught Lyme disease and is using cannabis as a therapeutic. So I'll be having that interview coming. I have another one. I'm looking at cannabis amnesty. Another word I have trouble with, amnesty. And again, how in Canada right now, there's about 500,000 people that have criminal records of cannabis that need to be dealt with. I've also been trying to figure out in Manitoba how to have a cannabis dinner. Because we were pre-pandemic, we were going to have a cannabis dinner. So I went looking for permits. In the province of Manitoba, you can drink alcohol in public places and get a permit. But cannabis, there are no permits. Which leads me to another potential story. At Dauphin's Country Fest, which is our big, big music festival in Dauphin, 10,000 people come to Dauphin and plug our town up. They're going to have a Delta 9 mobile cannabis store.
Let's ask them how that's licensed. So, that sounds like a good story.
Well, how's that? That sounds like a fantastic story. So what's the expectation of buying cannabis at a music festival? Because in Manitoba, at a campsite, and you've heard us say this before, people, at a campsite, you can consume cannabis if it's a registered campsite. Can you consume cannabis in a public place? And the Solo Grounds, where Country Fest is held, is a public place. So will cannabis consumption be ignored or is it permitted? So it's another one of those, it's not me saying, hey, psst, I'm going to get Country Fest in trouble. It's more how we keep pushing the laws. We keep pushing the laws to get our politicians to wake up to the fact that, you know, cannabis is actually safer than alcohol, but yet we allow children 10 years old to advertise cannabis. You know, I think the last time I was at a country fest, they were handing out fanny packs that said Bombay on rum. It. So Bombay is some sort of sweet alcoholic rum drink. I don't know. I don't drink it, but it comes in a can, and we're getting our children to advertise it for us. alcohol. It's been in our society for so long, we allow children to advertise it. But cannabis, oh my God. Let's keep cannabis away from the children. So yeah, I'm quite excited about it, Trevor. I think it's marvelous to see how big business can push government, but the little guy like us who are just trying to have a dinner get no. Well, I'm going to keep pushing and keep pushing.
We'll find something. So Kirk, I think we'll call. I don't think we said who we are yet. So I'm Trevor Seufeld. I'm the pharmacist.
And I'm Kirk Nyquist. I'm the registered nurse, and we're Reefer Madness, the podcast. And I ask people to go to our website, www.reefermed.ca. And for all those millennials out there, let's just say reefermed.ca. You don't even have to do, did you hear, you don't even have to do the www anymore?
that must have had something to do with the retirement of Internet Explorer. It must happen the same time.
Correct. Yeah, anyways, it was a good My Cannabis story. Thank you, Dr. Anderson. I enjoyed listening to your journey. Thank you for going through it so the rest of us can benefit.
Yes, thank you very much, and have a good day, everybody. We'll talk to you next time.
All right, guys, that was another good one. Thank you, Dr. Anderson. So it's Renee here back in the studio, and I guess it's time for me to pick a song to end the show off with. Listening to a couple of things there near the tail end that stood out. I heard a lot of talk about alcohol, and I heard about Kirk drinking bad milk. So the song that we're going to play to end off the show is Milk and Alcohol by Dr. Feelgood. Oh, and heads up, we've got a special little episode coming up. We'll call it E88, where Trevor and Kirk were at Country Fest and actually met the staff working on Canada's first mobile cannabis shop. So we'll be posting that shortly. Okay, here we go with the tune. Enjoy.
Like the show? Let us know. We're Reefer Madness on Instagram and Facebook, at Reefer Madness on Twitter, or head over to the website at reefermad.ca to find out what we're all about and what's coming up next. Talk to you later.
White boy in town, big black, blue sound, nightclub, I paid in, I got a stamp on my skin. Man attraction with the dead on his feet, black man rhythm with a white boy beat. Got him on milk and alcohol. They got him on milk and alcohol. Stay put, I wanna go. Hard work, bad show. More liquor, don't help. He's gonna die, breaks my heart. I decided eventually this ain't doing anything.
Here, let me turn off the recording stuff first. Stop.
that? Yes, I am sure. Okay, let me turn off the recording on this thing.